Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. You ever sit back and, in a contemplative state, sip or bite into an item of processed food, trying to visualize the process of its production based on its synthetic flavor and texture? Vats of corn syrup juice getting mixed together, or a frosting gun injecting fresh rolls as they zip past on a conveyor belt. These are just guesstimations and unbased daydreams, but who's really to say how that honey bun got assembled, when most of us can't track our food back past the label it wears? Today on RCP, we're going to try to peel back that label a bit to better see the system that delivers us our food. We'll at least try to understand the strange world from which our food is spawned, because after all, we are what we eat. It's not easy for most people to simply get a behind-the-scenes tour from the food industry. But luckily for us, the U provides a unique window in. As a place for educating future industry workers, classes introduce students to industry practices that are usually more concealed. Ben Hallam has more.
As a liberal arts student, I spend most of my time on the Minneapolis area of the University of Minnesota campus, especially on the West Bank. And when you're there, when all the students around you are studying things like sociology or English or math or philosophy or political science, it's easy to forget that the original mission of the University of Minnesota had nothing to do with the liberal arts. The University of Minnesota, like many public universities around the country, is a moral land-grant college, founded in the 1860s with the goal of spreading the knowledge of agriculture, science, military science, and engineering. The government didn't fund these moral land-grant colleges so that they could teach the liberal arts, but so that they could carry out practical education that would improve people's lives and society. However, even though I might sometimes forget about it, the University of Minnesota hasn't stopped pursuing this practical mission laid out in the Moral Land-Grant Act. The mission of teaching practical agriculture continues right here in the Twin Cities, on the St. Paul campus. To find out more about this aspect of the university, I visited the meat and dairy showroom on the St. Paul campus, where meats and cheeses produced in the university meat and dairy lab by students are sold.
There, I spoke to Tristan McNamara, one of the program's supervisors.
I'm Tristan McNamara. I'm the supervisor at the meat lab. I've been here at the university for almost 10 years. I started as an undergraduate student working part-time in the lab, and then I took on a full-time position when I graduated in 2009, and I've been here ever since.
The meat and dairy sales room, where I spoke to Tristan, was a small room filled with the hum of refrigerators, as I kept the products produced in the meat lab carefully preserved. Sausages, steaks, ground meat, all produced on campus by students, line the shelves of these refrigerators.
The University Meat Lab allows students to have direct contact with every aspect of meat processing, going from the farm all the way to the final sales room. Or, as Tristan put it, students practice
everything from live animal harvest all the way down to our retail products and everything. And all the animals are also raised here on campus, either here on the St. Paul campus or some of the outreach centers like Rosemount or Morris or Crookston or places like that.
As I spoke with Tristan, I couldn't help from thinking of one word that stuck out in the Moral Land Grant Act. Practical. The University of Minnesota Meat and Dairy Lab, as much as any other part of the university, sticks to this word's original meaning, providing a practical encounter with our food production system that students could not get anywhere else.
And we employ about from 8 to 12 student employees throughout the year, varies from semester to semester, but these students get a chance to get a hands-on, kind of a hands-on learning experience of what it takes to process meat and also sell meat products. It's basically a part-time job for them, and it's a chance to learn more about meat processing.
Though the meaning of being a moral land-grant college has changed over the years, and grown to include research in areas like chemistry, astrophysics, sociology, and history. The original meaning, research in practical science and agriculture and engineering, designed to improve people's lives and give students a hands-on experience in the industries in which they will work, continues on the St. Paul campus and around the university, in areas like the Meat and Dairy Lab. Programs like this one, which offer students a real chance to engage with our food system and work in it as a producer, can encourage them to go on to future careers in food production, an often forgotten industry that's central to human life.
If they choose to, they can go on to a master's program in meat science, and those students typically do go on to meat careers, I guess I should say.
Even though Tristan might laugh, these meat careers are incredibly important in a nation which eats over 200 million pounds of meat every day. And meat production is a major industry.
It could go anywhere from working in a meat plant, doing a quality assurance type of work for food companies, or even a research and development for companies like a Jack Link's or other food companies like that.
Usually, when I think of universities and what goes on inside them, I think of something like the classic European university, like Oxford or Cambridge. I think of old, grand buildings. I think of professors deep within libraries studying over ancient copies of Shakespeare or the Bible or Greek myths. I think of research about the classics, about philosophy, about mathematics. But the Meat and Dairy Lab is something different. It's something specifically American. The Meat and Dairy Lab is connected to the core idea behind the Morrill Land Grant Act, the idea of a university that isn't cut off from the world around it, but instead deeply integrated into it. A university that isn't just dedicated towards abstract ideas, but also to improving the daily lives of the people who live and work around it. It's about a university that is, as the Morrill Land Grant Act says, practical. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
A century ago, more than half the population of the United States was rural. Today, less than 20% of the country is, and only 2% are farmers. The vast majority of us now live in urban environments far, far away from the vast fields in which our food is grown. In this transition, the route food must travel from the soil to our lips has lengthened dramatically to new degrees of separation. Stretched out like a highway, there are many sights to see along this long route. Squared fields stretch to the horizon, massive machinery, factories, and farms, giant structures of science and technology, guiding food along its journey to its final destination, our bellies. These structures of food production are totally alien to an outsider, but there are some specialized individuals who go to work in these labs, factories, and farms each and every day. Just over a year ago, I crossed, almost accidentally, into one such lab, the Hughes Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory.
We're set up to process biosafety level 2, so everything we touch, we need to make sure we're wearing a lab coat to protect our
All body. I knew was that the job title listed online was student lab technician, and looking for a summer lab position of any kind, I applied. When I was being trained in my first day on the job, I was confused to find that one of my main tasks in the lab had not been mentioned explicitly in the interview. A large portion of my job turned out to be sample processing, essentially taking new shipments of animal fluids and pouring the bodily, sometimes globular, multicolored juices off into smaller tubes. The most common sample was called processing fluid.
So processing fluid is actually one of our newest specimen types. Processing in a pig production facility means that they clip the tails and the testicles off of the animals that they're not actually going to be used for breeding. They're going to be used for food. And they do that young, and then they collect all of that material in sterile buckets. And they'll take that fluid that actually seeps out of the tissue material and puts it into tubes for us to test. And it's actually
gross. Why would a lab spend its time doing something so gross? In the following months I spent at the lab, I started to piece together what purpose it served and why it was so essential.
really starts with or involves entirely the pig. Mm-hmm. And so we want to keep pigs healthy.
Ultimately, without the lab, pork as an affordable food in Minnesota and across the country might well be impossible.
Okay, this is Stephanie Rosso. I'm a swine pathologist at the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. I've been here at the lab since 1998. Healthy pigs will lead to several things. It makes them profitable to raise. Mm-hmm. If it's people can't make money raising them, pay their bills, you know, send kids to University of Minnesota, etc., they're not going to raise pigs. And so there is a need and a want in the United States and throughout the world for high-quality protein. Mm-hmm. And so that's what pigs are, that's what poultry are, that's what cattle are. Minnesota is the second largest producer of pigs in the U.S. It's kind of a surprise to a lot of people when they hear that. And so we try to take care of our economy. So we've developed here at the university reputation specialty in both pig diagnostics and pig research. Our clientele is all around Minnesota. Again, our service is predominantly rural. And so we're kind of like a hidden gem here sitting by the fairgrounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, correct. So we can get in samples from North Carolina, from Oklahoma, Colorado. We get samples from Mexico and some other South American countries. So I'm Tracy Otterson, and I work for the Vet Diagnostic Laboratory on the St. Paul campus. We're taking a tour of the laboratory, the molecular diagnostic laboratory specifically. And we're starting adjacent to our necropsy floor in the kitchen.
The pig lab is busy 5 days a week, year-round, from 8 a.m. in the morning on into the evening. The rush starts in the morning as soon as the first shipment of pig juice arrives.
You know, last year we probably processed 400,000 different samples and did 400,000 different tests. So Michelle's going to copy everything. She's going to grab all the samples that have been assigned a case number, mm-hmm. And then we'll bring them over to the lab.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. In the lab, workers move about, pouring thousands of samples into smaller tubes, the first step in diagnosing the animals from which the samples are taken.
What Becca's doing here is... Do you want to describe what you're doing?
Wait, what are you doing?
Is that kosher?
Podcast.
Yeah, yeah. This is the podcast.
Could you describe what you were doing? What yeah. You're doing right now?
So I am taking a saliva sample, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be putting it in a tube so that's easier.
When it comes to the types of pig juices farmers choose to send the lab, the decision is made based on ease and efficiency, outweighing the grossness factor.
It's a saliva sample, so saliva is basically sample taken from pigs where it they collect it from a rope that the pigs chew on, mm-hmm. and they just squeeze out the saliva from it.
Yeah. It's actually a pretty good specimen type just to screen for a lot of different diseases. Mm-hmm. So serum is the most difficult sample type to collect from pigs because you have to actually get up close, you have to restrain them, you have to use a needle and actually withdraw blood from the animal. Oral fluids is like a fun thing that pigs do because they like to chew on, you know, ropes and other pigs and fences and this is attractive to them, so it's almost like a game. Processing fluids is another kind of convenient specimen type because they're doing it anyway. They have to do something with that material. Right. Why not test it, you know? So...
From this point, the samples are fed into a complicated sequence of centrifuges and incubators, all types of sciencey equipment with names like
Magmax Express 96, which is...
This entire complex process had to be painstakingly developed and refined, a task requiring a huge investment of time and money, and something that would not have been done unless it was absolutely necessary. Earlier in the century, farmers were able to operate successfully without any such lab testing, simply raising and selling pigs locally. But as demand for pork rose, farming practices had to evolve to keep pace. Newer farming methods, striving for efficiency, made the industry larger and more interconnected than ever before, inadvertently leading to ideal conditions for contagious diseases.
with the number of pigs on the road every day, probably over a million pigs moving around in the U.S. in trucks and trailers every day. Said once it gets in here, there's so much traffic around that it's just hard to keep something from spreading around. So it's just like the virus hit the jackpot and went wild. And so
the virus, which the lab specializes in detecting, is known as the porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, or PRRS virus.
Okay, so PRRS first kind of popped up on the radar in the late 1980s. It was characterized by abortion. And specifically, why it's important, it'll infect sows in late gestation or late pregnancy, causes abortion, and so there's loss of all those piglets. So it's a real severe loss for new pigs, and then also then in really young pigs, it causes a severe respiratory disease that can kill young pigs by itself. Not only the pig health suffers, and there's lots of added expense for treatment. With the size of the sow farms today, and this is a number of years ago, an estimate, PRRS outbreak in a sow farm can probably run upwards to a cost of $1 million. It's still a very challenging disease to date to try to control. People would love to get rid of it, but without a really effective vaccine, that will be very difficult.
Because vaccines are not a reliable option for dealing with the PRRS virus, other methods are needed to prevent its spreading. The diagnostic lab provides an affordable option using a method called polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. The pigs can be diagnosed quickly, giving farmers the ability to prevent the mixing of healthy animals with sick ones.
Back when I started, back in the olden days, PCR was not commonly used at all. It wasn't used for routine diagnostics. And the gold standard still commonly used was virus isolation, which may be 1 to 2 weeks before you can get virus to grow. And that is just really not relevant to how pigs are raised anymore. It's when they move pigs or want to find out if pigs are infected so they can try to minimize transmission, it's something they need to know, you know, like now or yesterday. And so waiting 1 to 2 weeks to see if a virus grows, too slow. Again, just that opportunity to have samples come in and essentially today and get a result today is nearly priceless for producers and veterinarians to help keep pigs healthy. And so we run PRRS PCR testing twice a day, 5 days a week here.
So this room is, which is room 110, is dedicated for our extraction and our...
The PCR process goes like this, essentially.
So the lysis's job is to actually burst the cells of the virus or bacteria. That
cells from the pig juices are broken open, and the genetic material, the DNA and RNA, is separated from the other gunk.
Acid, so any kind of RNA that might be in a virus, DNA that might be in a virus.
The extracted genetic material is then mixed with some helpful enzymes that bind onto specific sections of the RNA found in the virus and copy these sections when at the proper temperature.
Yes, yep. So there's a thermal cycler contained in here, so they have, that's why they're really loud. They have a lot of air.
The PCR machine cycle takes the RNA through fluctuations in temperature from hot to cold. When hot, the DNA separates and is clamped onto by identifying enzymes.
Cycle back up to 97 and melt that DNA.
Cold, another enzyme attaches and copies any virus DNA it encounters.
About 60 degrees, your primers will actually go down and find their targets.
The cycle is repeated 40 times. After the cycling, the amount of virus DNA in the mixture will indicate how much was in the sampled pig, if any at all.
How many copies of virus are present?
And why is it so important that the client gets to see the results right away?
They are, a lot of them are very interested in knowing immediately what the results are because they want to move their animals to a different area. They want to start a treatment plan right away. They may want to know if where they got a particular infection from. A lot of it is just status, establishing the status of their animals so they know what to do with them downstream.
And so the pig lab processes the fluids of pigs from all over, keeping vets and farmers up to date on their animals' health. The highly scientific service that this lab provides thus allows the pork industry to continue churning out bacon at an industrial scale. It's science to the rescue of our massive food system yet again.
Again, I think we're priceless for the state of Minnesota, for keeping the animal population, helping to keep them healthy, and said, I just love what we do and really appreciate the people here, that their expertise that they develop, their dedication to their job.
And then we just start over again the next day. As some people like to say, pigs never take a vacation. so we like to, we have to make sure we're available to our clients, you know, every day.
Yeah.
So it's true. They keep being pigs.
It's clear that high-tech solutions like the lab are essential supports for our food system at its current scale. But some do not find comfort in these engineered solutions. A legitimate question is if our current industrial food system, which makes food into a commodity, is the right kind of food system, if it should be supported at all. Only steps away from the pig lab on the St. Paul campus, somebody is fostering an alternative food system. Liv Riggins has more.
I first met Francis at the Native American Medicine Garden at the U of M's St. Paul campus, between agricultural experiment test plots. Francis was alone in the field, tending a pile of organic matter, turning it over and over with a pitchfork.
I am Chante Sutta, Francis Betleon. I am Oglala Lakota. I am the coordinator of the Native American Medicine Gardens on the St. Paul campus at the University of Minnesota.
Quickly after talking with Francis, it became apparent that these medicine gardens are different from the agricultural operations they are grouped with in the field. The medicine gardens are not about simply producing food. Food is connected to the land, to people, and all other living beings, so it isn't a question of raising new species or experimenting to get higher yields at the medicine gardens. This different mission has much to do with reclaiming the land and relearning ways of being with the land that have been damaged by colonialism over the past several centuries.
This is important for everybody to understand. We are on Dakota land, and actually the land of the Ocheti Shakowin, which is the seven council fires of the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota people. This is unceded land that everybody is benefiting on in this university and Minneapolis-St. Paul and all southern Minnesota that settlers are occupying right now. The trauma of colonization and the trauma of being forced off your land, off of a land that had your food system, that everything that existed here gave you the ability to thrive. And now we're put into these situations where the depression is high, that mental illness is high. All these things are part of what has happened and what continues to happen. We have the knowledge, we have to recover. And that's what we're doing right now, is we're recovering from genocide, extermination policies, which are mostly still in place. I wanted to start there because it's important that people understand what the importance is of this garden, this land. This was our food system. It was stolen from us. And it's important for us to talk about that because people will look at us mainly in a way that, why aren't you doing these things? Why aren't you assimilating into the system? It's not ours. This is your system. This was forced upon us. So we're trying to come together, heal through what we've been through, heal the land, and grow our own food, the indigenous food that we survived on. Not just survived, but thrived on, and we're healthy. So this garden is part of that. It's telling our history, where we were, what we've been through, but where we are now, and what we're still going through. In my culture, the Lakota culture, is that as an individual, I have to know how to do everything to survive. That's how we're taught. We're taught how to gather food, process it, ferment it, can it, all those things that we've learned along the way, but what we knew before and carry forward into where we are now. We have the knowledge. We just have to practice it.
And for Francis, practicing these ways of being with the land means moving away from industrial modes of production and industrial relationships, both with the land and with other people, and towards more holistic and healing relationships with food, land, and others.
We healed Mother Earth. We healed her in a way that we knew how to do. I've learned that process through the years. I learned it from my great-grandmother and others. I went to South Dakota State University. I'm a landscape designer. But my full concentration is on the soil, healing her and getting her the medicines, the compost, so she can build organic matter back into her own system. I can take care of Mother Earth. I can feed from her what she grows, what I put in seeds, plants. I can build my own shelter, actually living independently from everything that we know right now. The things that we have right now are just wants. Most of them are wants. They're not needs. The highways, the buildings, computers, technology, all these things, electricity, we didn't have it. We were thriving. This changed things. People look at technology as human evolution and going into even far beyond human experience, that it's part of it. Actually, you're taken away from this, the natural world that you're most aren't connected to anymore. And if you're missing life, actually, the natural process is a natural way of life. When you're stuck in a society that believes that everything is a commodity, when food became a commodity, that destroyed us and is going to destroy us, because it puts everybody into a really hard situation that everybody has to work now for food. So food sovereignty is part of that, is that we need to have food free again. And people, how do we do that? It's impossible. We did it. Cultures around the world did it and are still doing it, and we're coming back to that.
But to do so, there would have to be a massive change in the way that food is made and the way that we relate to it.
We have to think beyond what we are. We're sitting on the St. Paul campus where this modern agricultural system is. It's one of those that is part of climate change, a huge part of what's going on with the climate. Farmers have to learn how to grow food and not crops to feed livestock and ethanol. We have to think differently. Of you as an individual, what are you willing to sacrifice and give up in order for us to actually have healthy food again? The soil needs to be healed, you know, she needs to be healed, the water needs to be healed. So if we don't take our responsibility in this, then why are we here? We have to get back to those ways. We have to get back to what it means to be a human, and not that we control everything, but we are a part of everything.
Food is, of course, more than just our sustenance. American food carries with it a uniquely American history, the collision of the old and new worlds. The foods we eat reflect a combination of sorts, of native and colonizer cultures. As Casey McCabe explains, the dynamics can be seen even in a simple grocery run to Trader Joe's.
With the end of the school year, we are all confronted with a rather pleasant opportunity, the chance to eat a home-cooked meal. For freshmen like me, that means leaving behind the dining hall food forever, and for some, it means trading in ramen for a few nights of your parents' finest cooking. This semester, I took the class Food and History, which was taught by Professor Jessica Arnett. Although I am returning to my parents' kitchen for the summer, I will be living with roommates in an apartment next year, and I'm the only one that knows how to cook. In an effort to get out ahead of the ball, I asked my professor where I should go to purchase groceries.
And I do most of my shopping actually at the Trader Joe's that just opened right next to campus, which I think is a pretty amazing location. I was pretty excited when it opened. But I find that they have really good food there that's a little bit less expensive than your traditional grocery stores. And they have novelty items that I'm really kind of becoming accustomed to, if you will.
Such as, are there any Trader Joe's novelty items you'd like to
share? Oh, sure. Well, they have, their own brand of what I guess would be peanut M&Ms, and I typically have a bag of those in the middle console of my car. And so when I've run out of those, then I know that I need to go back to Trader Joe's and get more chocolate.
After asking Professor Arnett about where she does her shopping personally, I was curious where her family shops for their groceries.
My family does most of their shopping at the local supermarket. They live in a small town in northern Ohio after they moved from Kentucky. So there's only about 5,000 people in Wellington, Ohio. And so there's two little grocery stores, and that's where they do most of their shopping. In terms of the price, I would think that it's probably pretty comparable to things that, you know, I would purchase on a daily basis. And I think, you know, that also has a lot to do with my family's upbringing. You know, they grew up, my grandparents grew up during the Great Depression, and so that definitely affected, I think, their mindset, you know, when they're buying food and shopping for their families to try to do things as inexpensively as possible.
I found it interesting that my conversation with my history professor about grocery shopping somehow found its way back into history. I decided to embrace this and asked her the question that had long been racking my brain since I first enrolled in the course. What comes to your mind when you hear the phrase white people food?
When I hear that phrase, you know, I suppose I think of, I guess my family's food, you know, the potato salad, you know, the coleslaw. I'm trying to think of other things that we, you know, put together at family gatherings. We do a lot of cookouts, you know, so those, you know, kind of typical, quote unquote, American standard fare, you know, things that people associate with, American eating habits, you know, meat, potatoes.
Yep.
Things of that nature.
In the course Food and History, we discussed the appropriation of food of other cultures by Western civilizations. This is in general a bad thing, but did result in the birth of the Taco Bell burrito on which I am currently munching. Although quote-unquote Americanized food can be delicious, I asked my professor if this cultural phenomenon is a bad thing.
I think it depends. I think there are instances, of course, you know, where the appropriation of cultures and foodways of, you know, otherwise marginalized groups is definitely, you know, a problem and lends itself to particular kinds of exploitation that are parallel with other kinds of exploitation and oppression. But I also do think that there are instances of adaptation that are important, particularly thinking about the example from our class about the development of chop suey.
Yep.
By Chinese immigrants and the way that they developed that to appeal to an American palate and how that was, you know, an economic stabilizing kind of entity for them to be able to, you know, create this dish and market it and, you know, make a living in what was otherwise a very exclusive labor market. The Chinese faced a lot of discrimination, a lot of exclusion from typical labor and employment. And so that was a way to sort of combat that and sort of resist that exclusion.
I hope that you enjoy your families, your food, and your summer. Reporting one last time as a freshman for Radio K, I'm Casey McCabe.
And that's all for this episode of RCP. Thanks to all those faculty and staff of the U who donated their voices and tasteful perspectives this week. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hollum, Liv Riggins, Lizzie Ritchie, and Tassin Fasimo. I'm Nathan Fervo, your host and managing editor. Music included this week was from Anne LaPlantine. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at RadioK.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can follow us on Instagram for a look behind the scenes. Thanks for listening.